It's a while since we discussed it, but I do recall doing a program years ago on Marco Polo where it was argued that many of his splendid adventures were at least somewhat fictional. Now, shock horror, the critics have been turning on Antonio and Niccolo Zen. Once upon a time, back in the 14th century, they made some very daring history-making sea voyages from their base in Venice. They discovered new lands as they went further than other Europeans had into the North Atlantic. Or did they? Hailed as heroes, the Zen brothers and their descendants were subsequently denounced as hoaxers. Now, Italian historian and journalist Andrea Di Robolant has decided to try and solve the puzzle, and it's become an obsession. The result is a fine book called Venetian Navigators, The Voyages of the Zen Brothers to the Far North. He's here for the Perth and Adelaide festivals. Right now he's in our Melbourne studio. Andrea, thanks for joining us. Tell us that wonderful story about the day you were working in a library in Venice when, in a sense, lightning struck.
Well, yes. Hi, Philip. It's good to be here and good to be in Australia for me. Anyway, yes, that moment was really the beginning of it all for me. I was in the library, as you said, I was in the library in Venice at this beautiful Renaissance building, the Biblioteca Marciana. And I was, this was over 10 years ago, and I was working on another book. And then I see this American tourist dawdling in the library. He was just off from a cruise ship in shorts and beanie cap and so on. And
not an encouraging sight.
Clearly, he needed help, and so
sartorial advice for
right, also, but I wouldn't dare. But I went up to him and asked him what he was looking for, and he had with him a little piece of paper, and on this piece of paper were the names of Niccolò and Antonio Zen, and these names meant absolutely nothing to me. But more surprisingly was what he said to me. He said, in the little town in Connecticut where I come from, we all know that these two Venetians discovered America in 1390. And so I looked at him askance and thought, my goodness, okay, very well. And what he was looking for was the house of these two fellows so that he could have a picture taken and go back to his, get back on the boat and go to his town. I pulled out a book to show him where one Palazzo Zen was, and he was on his way.
Now, sorry to interrupt, but the vast majority of geographers and historians assume the story is apocryphal. Why did you get excited about it? This incident occurs, but what triggered the real obsession, as you describe it, in yourself?
Well, I guess the more I read about it and the more I got to know the characters involved, the more I realized there was it was really very reductive and simplistic to say that it was an apocryphal tale. Instinctively, I felt that there was a lot of truth in the tale, but that obviously wasn't enough. I decided that since the main culprit in this tale is the man who actually put the book together. He was a descendant of one of the two navigators. In 1558, he puts together a book based on, supposedly, the letters that the two navigators had sent back home. And he draws a map of the North Atlantic in 1558. And it's an extraordinary map, and it was hugely influential in cartography, in Renaissance cartography, and later on. And in fact, it was so influential that Elizabeth I used it as the basis for the launch of a British empire in North America. So it was, to me, all of this was very fascinating. And I felt that I had to begin by establishing what kind of a person the man who had actually put the book together, Niccolò Zen the Younger, was. And the more I dug into his past and worked in the archives, I realized that this man was not, didn't have at all the profile of a fable monger. He was an extraordinary statesman with extraordinary talents. He was a hydraulic engineer. He was an expert in Latin and Greek. He was a historian, and he was a statesman. And it just seemed completely implausible to me that this fellow would ruin his reputation for centuries by putting together a forged book about his ancestors.
We let us remind or tell the listener, Andrea, that you're also the author of A Venetian Affair, which I thought was terrific, and you come recommended by no less a colleague than Simon Sharma, who says, immediate, vivid and powerful, the best novel I've read in years, except that it happens to be true. I am grateful to you for teaching me what lingua franca means. Now, it's a part of our story, and I just thought of it as any language widely used, but you point out that it was a very important language, that it was made up of many linguistic threads.
Yes, it was, but it was spoken by in all havens, ports, small and big, across the Mediterranean. It was a language that came together spontaneously and had elements of Catalan, Portuguese, Spanish, Italian, and many other languages. And it's the language that the seamen spoke in all the harbors of the Mediterranean. What is tragic is that there's no written record of this language, which was, for all intents and purposes, the equivalent of English in the Middle Ages in the harbors of Europe.
The Mediterranean wasn't a big enough pond for these blacks, was it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, by the 14th century, the Venetians had been in a very long feud with the Genoese over dominance of the Mediterranean trade. And finally, after a century of wars, naval battles and so on, the Venetians defeated the Genoese and had pretty much control over Mediterranean trade. But they also realized by the time our two Venetian merchants sailed to the North Atlantic that it wouldn't be enough to trade in the Mediterranean if Venice was to remain the great mercantile power that it was. And so they felt that they had to try and get a foothold in the new trade in the North Atlantic. And in particular, they needed to get involved in the cod trade.
I hadn't realized that dried cod was such a valued commodity, the preferred staple of armies, monasteries, and sizable populations.
Well, yes, I of course knew nothing of all this, and it was a wonderful discovery. But it's absolutely true. Once you realize, and it makes perfect sense, dried cod is easily transportable. It, as you say, was the preferred commodity for standing armies. And so just for that reason, it was very important to secure a chunk of the market.
Now, we understand the motivation of the Zen brothers. Incidentally, I'm talking to Andrea de Robelin, historian and journalist, about Venetian navigators. One of the things that turns up in the book and the map is Frieslander. Now, this is a new land founded by the original Zen brother, or was it? True or false?
Ah, very, very interesting question. Well, they write back to their family, the Zen brothers, write back that they were shipwrecked near Frieslander and made a landing in Frieslander. Now, of course, we've all wondered, I mean, the people who have studied these voyages have always wondered what this Frieslander was. Feeling is that, in fact, it wasn't one island, but it was two, and it was the Faroe Islands combined with Orkney. And it was simply a colossal blunder, a mistake on the part of Niccolò Zen the Younger, the man who put together the map. He misused the information that his forefathers had left to him, and created this huge lumpish island north of Scotland called Frieslanda. And if you look at the map closely, you will see that phonetically there are names that belong to Faroes and names that belong to Orkney, and that is really the main reason why I think that he made a mistake and made one big island with two.
Andrea, the account has them surrounded by a group of men with axes, picks and stones, who were dispersed by a local lord who greeted them in Latin. How could that possibly be?
Well, of course, when I first read it, I thought it was completely implausible. But then, again, you look, you do a little bit of research, and it is very likely that the person who rescued them, or under whose wing the Zen brothers came after being saved after the shipwreck, was the Earl of Orkney himself, Henry Sinclair. Now, Henry Sinclair spoke Latin very well. He had learnt it as a child and as a school in Scotland. He was very familiar with Venetian history. He had probably been to Venice himself. So what seems an implausible encounter between a Venetian navigator and a local leader who speaks Latin and knows all about Venetian history is in fact very plausible when you look it up close.
It must have been exciting. You must have had little frissons every other day as you found bits and pieces of this mosaic.
Well, yes, and then I also had a lot of moments of complete disappointment and despair when I thought I'd never get to the end of this tale. But of course, every little discovery brought on what you call a frisson of emotion. I would just want to add one more thing about Frieslanda, because Frieslanda continued to survive in the maps of Europe for centuries. And in fact, again, going back to Queen Elizabeth, she sent countless ships, well, not countless, we know exactly how many ships she sent under the command of Martin Frobisher to look for Frieslanda. So this is just to give you a sense of the impact that the Zen map had on Renaissance cartography and on Renaissance politics, for that matter.
I understand that you actually went to Frieslanda, wandered around to try and suss it out.
Well, because at a certain point it became irresistible. There I was in the Library of Venice trying to make sense of this seemingly senseless tale. And so the only thing to do was to get a backpack and go looking for traces of these merchants. And so I did go to Orkney and to Shetland and to the Faroe Islands and to Iceland and to Greenland looking for traces of these men. And, of course, there were a number of occasions in which I really did ask myself what the hell I was doing.
But did you pick up anecdotal stuff or, you know, little shards of legend that made you feel you were onto something?
Yes, I did find elements that seemed to corroborate parts of the stories. But I also met a lot of people who were very aggressive with me and who thought I shouldn't be poking around in those islands spinning a yarn of Venetian navigators, and in fact I can remember one incident in the Shetland Islands when the head librarian in Lerwick, the capital of the Shetlands, was enraged with me, and he said, "This is all rubbish, and you shouldn't be here looking for these Venetians. What do you all know about these areas?" And so I was often surprised by the animosity that this story...
But how do you account for that? I find the animosity perplexing.
Well, the animosity is really what made me... what kept me going, because I kept asking myself, but why can they be so angry with men who lived 600 years before?
It happens in religious circles, but I would have thought...
Well, Well, because it is, because they had espoused the theory that this was a forgery, and so they could not accept that someone was trying to go to the bottom of it, and it made them very, very upset.
Are you winning converts, apart from Simon Sharma? Have you turned the tide?
Well, having Simon Sharma on my side is already very important. But the thing is, you see, that I didn't really set out to establish the truth. I don't think it's possible anymore. Too much has been said. Too much blood has been spilled over this story. I think the guiding principle in my research and in the way I set out the book is a principle of plausibility. I mean, what makes sense? I mean, given the facts we do know, what seems like the plausible explanation for the story?
There's a neat little ending, not that we're at the ending yet, but the American in the library in Venice.
He reappears.
Tell us about the circumstances of that.
Well, that's a funny part of the story. I had said to myself early on, because of the complexities of this story, that I really should stay away from it, that I should not try to write a book about it because it would get me into a terrible, complicated mess and I would waste a lot of time and so. But eventually, as you said in the early part of the program, I became obsessed with it and I realized that if I just didn't start working on it and traveling and so on, I would remain obsessed by it. And so I started working on it, and soon word spread on the internet because there are a lot of people who know about this story. I mean, in America, there are societies for the Zen Brothers. There are societies.
It's such a wonderful name, isn't it? The Zen Brothers.
Zen, yes. A vaguely Oriental sound, So word spread on the internet that I was doing this book. And so one day I received an email out of the blue from a man, from an American who says, "Hello, my name is Tom Paul. I've heard that you're writing, researching a book on the Zen Brothers. And I just wanted to let you know for your information that a few years back, I myself was in Venice on a cruise ship, and I stepped down and went into a library asking for where the house of the Zen Brothers was. And there was a gentleman there who helped me, but he didn't seem to believe in my tale." And
this is almost Jungian synchronicity, isn't it?
And I thought, how wonderful that this story is coming around full circle.
Well, dare I ask whether you've come to any tentative views about whether either of the Zen brothers discovered the New World?
Well, I certainly believe the two Zen brothers existed. I certainly believe that they went on this journey in the North Atlantic. And there is a strong possibility in my mind. But again, this is what I... The most plausible outcome is it's not the truth. It's what I think is most plausible is that they did reach Newfoundland, and as they describe in their letters back home, they were repelled by the natives, and so were never able to establish a colony on Newfoundland. And after that, they left Newfoundland, sailed towards Labrador, and then veered to the right, and then it ended up in Greenland. This is what I think is the most plausible course of action.
It's interesting that a couple of years ago, and I think we did a program on it, we seem to do a program on most things, there was an argument that great voyagers headed out from China in junks and landed almost everywhere, but that's, I think, largely been disposed of, whereas your Zen story does seem to be gaining momentum. What about poor old Marco Polo? Where do his voyages stand these days?
Well, you know what? After having been discredited somewhat in a few decades ago, or certainly in the last 20 years, I think there's a big Marco Polo comeback. I think... a number of books have come out that seem to establish that Marco Polo did what he said he did, and that there is very little fiction in his wonderful book.
Yeah, what are you going to do for an encore? Are you going to sit around in Venetian libraries till another strange American?
Yeah, well, I got the thing is, you know, Philip, I really got fascinated with. I became fascinated with all this cartography business and map making, and Venice was really in the Renaissance, the center of it all.
Well, they had the technology to print them, didn't they?
Well, yes, and then they had hundreds of publishers and printers. It was really the mecca of publishing in Europe in the 16th century. And so it's really a fascinating world, and I have entered this world thanks to the Zen Brothers, and now I think I'd like to stick around for another book or so.
Well, there's so many stories that still remain to be told out of Venice, because as you say, it was, don't you think
it's
the mecca is probably the best description? But musical notation starts in Venice. I mean,
exactly.
Venice seemed to invent every second thing.
Yeah, well, a lot of these publishers made good money and certainly a living by publishing musical notations and specializing in musical notations. In fact, the publisher who published the Zen book, his name was Francesco Marcolini. He was a top-notch publisher, really a wonderful publisher, keen editor. Well, he started out by publishing musical sheets and musical notations.
Well, you found a top-line publisher as well, and that's Faber and Faber. Life's Twists and Turns. Andrea de Robiland has been my guest, the author of Venetian Navigators, The Voyages of the Zen Brothers. Faber and Faber. Oh, here through Annan and Unwin. But if you're heading to the Adelaide Festival, you might catch my guest there and get him to sign your copy. On our next, we talk to Susan Aulian, yet again, the author of The Orchid Thief. She's now turned her attention to the world's first dog superstar. No, not Lassie, but Rin Tin Tin. Rinnie was found in a bombed-out kennel in the French battlefields during World War I and became a megastar. And we'll also meet the wonderfully named Arthur Goldwag, who studied the new hate, details the history of fear and loathing within America's populist right, a topic which enchants both Mr. Shapiro and myself. So, here they come now. I'm under arrest. Until our next, don't go away. Someone else will be presenting Late Night Live in my absence in Guantanamo. Stick around on RN.